From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in the Castro,
Fillmore District,
Bernal Heights,
Oakland, California.
Coming up, Chevron is under fire, and not just for last month's pipe blast.
Chevron and other refineries aren't just supposed to routinely flare away these gases that build up in their refining process. They're supposed to only do it in an emergency.
Then San Francisco's plastic bag ban is about to be fully enforced. But is it really a step to save the planet?
Paper is much worse for the environment than plastic. Many times worse.
And get on your bikes. It's time for critical mass. And this time, it's a party.
And you're rolling down the streets and this kind of weird and surprising euphoria hit us all on that very first ride.
Taking over the streets of San Francisco for 20 years. Stay with us. Last month's explosion at the Chevron oil refinery in Richmond had the East Bay in shock.
I did not hear the sirens until maybe about 7 o'clock, okay? So you need to fix your system so that everybody in Richmond will get it.
One of the questions on people's minds was, how could this happen? And what systems does Chevron have in place to prevent it? A probe into the company's safety practices is underway. And now the San Francisco Chronicle has also discovered a federal criminal investigation into a possible cover-up of excess pollution being produced by the plant that goes back many years. KALW's Ben Trefney called up San Francisco Chronicle reporter Jackson Vanderbecken to talk about the latest developments. Vanderbecken was named Northern California's Journalist of the Year by the Society of Professional Journalists last year for his reporting on the San Bruno pipeline explosion. Here's what he had to say about the Chevron investigation.
They found what was a method by which Chevron could release the gases and toxic material that builds up in the refining process out a pipe and it not be measured by a monitor that's required to track a practice known as flaring, which is they burn off the impurities or the pressure buildup, and they're supposed to keep an eye on that and actually monitor it and sample it. But this particular pipe had been used more than 24 times to go directly to the top of what would otherwise be a flaring tower and bypassing, whether intentionally or not, the monitoring equipment inside the tower.
Well, what would be the advantage for Chevron to go ahead and divert around this monitoring equipment?
Well, the monitoring equipment is supposed to measure any time there's a flare. And any time there's a flare, there's a flare minimization plan in place and has been for a number of years, in which Chevron and other refineries aren't just supposed to routinely flare away these gases that build up in their refining process. They're supposed to only do it in an emergency. So in the 27 or so documented events, they flared without having to make a report or explain why they did it.
So they could, by diverting around the monitoring equipment, by flaring more often, they could conceivably run a dirtier plant.
Well, they would dispute that. They say that the amount of flaring involved here, based on their estimates, was minimal, minuscule, nothing. Which begs the question as to why they did it in the first place.
If you've seen the refinery, you know it's just filled with pipes after pipes after pipes. It's a massive, massive place. And I'm wondering how often and how carefully is it monitored? Because there's a lot to take a look at.
Well, it's a very large place, and there's a lot of things going on there. And in the three inspections that they did that weren't prompted by accidents or complaints, OSHA spent an average of 50 man hours per inspection. And this is thousands of acres, lots of industrial processes. And to go there for 50 hours once every 2 years, they can't turn up the whole place and, you know, turn it over. And it is true that the federal government had lagged as well upon doing these kind of inspections themselves. And after a 2005 accident in Texas involving the BP Texas City refinery, which a number of workers were killed, the federal government was called to account by the same body that's overseeing this probe, the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, for not doing more intensive inspections of oil refineries. As a result, they pledged this national emphasis program, which involved many states doing some of the work, and they themselves having a team that went into refineries, and they looked at over the 120 refineries in the United States. California has 15 refineries, and we totaled the amount of inspection efforts on all of them. They averaged about 50 man-hours per inspection across the board for all 15 refineries. Some have never been inspected. They have gone in because of accidents and complaints. But the federal standard, which dates back to the early 1990s, suggests that they should be intensive, high level of enforcement activity. Taking a team is envisioned to take some time in the refinery with experts and protocols and all of that. So, and the Fed's never been able to reach that standard themselves.
Let alone the state.
Let alone California.
So are there changes expected to come in place, and what kind of consequences could Chevron face based upon their potential infractions here in this criminal investigation?
Well, the criminal investigation handled by the United States Environmental Protection Agency, they could literally fine them thousands of dollars, presumptively hundreds of thousands of dollars, because it's a per-day kind of violation situation. In the end, however, most of these agencies are highly limited in how many type of violations they can seek, how much dollar amounts they can impose, and they almost universally claim that they just don't have enough firepower to deter conduct. I mean, for a $29 billion company last year for Chevron, $170,000 fine, you know, even which was the highest that they had paid in a decade, according to our view, is not, in some people's minds, a very significant amount.
That's San Francisco Chronicle reporter Jackson Vanderbecken speaking with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can hear an extended version of that conversation at KALW.org. And we'd like to get your take on the Chevron case. Is the corporation acting responsibly in Richmond? And what consequences should they face for their recent pipe issues, if any? Call our feedback line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And leave us a message. You might hear yourself on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Chevron is in the oil business, and like it or not, we pretty much all fuel that industry. It's not just when we drive our cars. Petroleum is in ink, in soap, in deodorants, in eyeglasses, paint, crayons, and of course, in plastic bags. But not so much in San Francisco. In February, the City Board of Supervisors approved the expansion of a ban on single-use plastic bags. The stricter ordinance goes into effect on Monday, expanding the supermarket ban to restaurants, hardware stores, gift shops, and virtually all retailers in the city. But it won't stop there. To discourage the use of single-use bags altogether, there'll be a 10-cent charge if you take a bag at checkout, plastic, paper, or compostable. Consumers aren't going to be the only ones on the hook. Stores will face fines for providing free bags. It all means that in San Francisco, the paper or plastic dilemma will be a question of the past. But there's another question we're not asking enough. Is the ban really helping our planet? KALW's Antoinette Sue reports.
Katy Perry's self-empowering anthem, Firework, is about teenage angst. Many of her songs are. But if you take her lyrics literally, you might hear a subtle message of environmental awareness.
Do you ever feel like a plastic bag drifting through the wind, wanting to start again?
San Francisco supervisors sometimes get that feeling too. But when it comes to passing legislation banning plastic bags, they're not afraid to show their true colors.
Supervisor Avalos, Aye.
Avalos, aye. President Chu?
Aye.
Chu, aye. Supervisor Cohen?
Aye.
Cohen, aye.
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 There are 10 ayes.
The amendment is approved. President Chu, to the item as amended.
Simply put, San Francisco officials care about the environment, and their efforts go way back.
San Francisco is poised to be the first city in the United States to move forward on legislation of this type.
In 2007, then-Supervisor Ross Mercurimi trumpeted the city's plastic bag ban.
This is revolutionary, and yet it's very simplistic on the face.
We have a goal of zero waste, and as audacious as that seems, I'm absolutely convinced we'll get there.
In 2009, then-Mayor Gavin Newsom told Current TV about his 10-year green plan.
So I've gotten rid of styrofoam takeout containers. That's why we've been aggressive on the water bottle issue more than any other city in America. That's why we banned plastic bags, and that's been replicated across the planet, including China.
Green's always been go in San Francisco. Mandatory recycling and composting has allowed the city to exceed its goal of diverting 3/4 of materials away from landfill. Plastic-reducing environmental policies regularly meet unanimous approval. But here's the thing. The initiatives aren't necessarily better for the environment.
San Francisco hasn't done any kind of study on the environmental impacts of plastic or paper or reusable bags. Never.
Stephen Joseph is counsel for the Save the Plastic Bag Coalition. Time magazine has called him the patron saint of plastic bags.
The paper is much worse for the environment than plastic, by many times worse, and that San Francisco had not taken that into account.
Paper bags are bulky compared with plastics. Estimates say plastic bags take up only 0.4% of landfill space, while paper bags take more than twice that.
We have to take steps to reduce paper in landfills because plastic doesn't decompose in a landfill, which is a good thing. I mean, environmentalists shriek when I say that, but you don't want anything decomposing in a landfill because it turns into greenhouse gases when it does.
Plastic bags take anywhere from 500 to 1,000 years to break down. And there are other arguments for plastic over paper. The American Progressive Bag Alliance found in 2007 that paper bags emit 2 to 3 times more greenhouse gases than their plastic counterparts. The same study concludes that paper bags take 4 times as much energy to make as plastic bags. But shoppers do need something to put their stuff in. So plastic bags are definitely a problem, but paper is not the solution. A more viable plan is initiating a trend toward reusing, and that's the next environmental frontier for the city of San Francisco.
We're not saying that businesses can't provide a bag. Right. There will just be a minimal charge for it.
That's Regina Dickendreese, the director of San Francisco's Office of Small Business. Come October 1st, the city will expand its existing plastic bag ban. All retailers must enforce the ban in their stores and charge a 10-cent fee for all bags at checkout.
From what I've seen, I think businesses now are trying to reduce their current inventory. If their current inventory of bags are not complying, making sure that they're, reducing that down. And I have been to some businesses where they are aware and they are aware of the timeline and so have done a gentle reminder.
But Stephen Joseph thinks the measures go too far. His Save the Plastic Bag Coalition is filing a lawsuit against the city for not presenting an environmental impact report.
In the sense that a paper bag fee is being charged, 10 cents is better than zero, but it's nowhere near enough. But the bigger problem with all of this is, why are they banning plastic bags in the first place? Is it really necessary? Is it good for the environment? Is there a real problem with plastic bags?
Plastic bags are one of the most commonly retrieved items on Coastal Cleanup Day every single year.
Allison Chan works with the environmental organization Save the Bay. I meet her in Golden Gate Park, one of few places in the city where refuse doesn't litter the streets.
The data published by the Ocean Conservancy every year shows that plastic bags are consistently at the top of the list. So you can't make that up. And then you also can't make up the fact that we're finding wildlife ingesting these products and that it that our cities are finding them clogging our storm drains, and that's actually an expense to our cities. Mm-hmm. So not only is this an environmental issue, but this becomes an economic burden for our cities as well.
It costs the city an estimated $8.5 million a year to manage waste resulting from plastic bags. but things are changing. San Francisco has seen 15% growth in the use of reusable bags since 2007. Chan says people elsewhere are taking notice.
There are legislators and statewide organizations that are also trying to make sure that plastic bag bans not only happen at the regional level, but statewide as well.
Rather than paying fees every visit to the store, shoppers may turn to reusable bags. As San Francisco moves forward with legislation and continues searching for waste solutions, the culture of reusing what we already have will be as important as ever to raise our city's sustainable standards. And the environmental awareness could have a ripple effect. When it comes to landmark policies, what happens in San Francisco doesn't just stay in San Francisco. For Cross Currents, I'm Antoinette Hsu.
So what do you think? Will the plastic ban really make a difference environmentally? Join the discussion on our Facebook page. We are KALW News. The bag ban in stores may catch some shoppers off guard next month, but it's just one of many surprises politicians may pull in October, at least according to political comedian Will Durst. Today, he's turning his attention to the home stretch of the presidential election, which will last all month long.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with a few words about the October surprise, the joker in the American electoral deck of cards. After most minds have been made up and money spent, a well-played October surprise can turn a game around quicker than three crews of replacement refs. Here's just a sample of the sort of shenanigans we can expect to see in the month of October. October 8th. Barack Obama announces a deal with Jamba Juice to place coupons for free fruit smoothies on the back of all 1040 forms. October 11th. Immediately after the vice presidential debate, Joe Biden disappears for the rest of the campaign. Nobody, including his personal staff, notices. October 13th. Mitt Romney vows, if elected, to personally write a $250 check to every man, woman, and child in America. Fox News calls it a game changer. October 15th. Donald Trump unveils a cave painting in Provence, France, that portrays a figure that looks eerily like Barack Obama descending from what appears to be a spaceship. October 18th. On the way to a rally in Langley, Virginia, President Barack Obama stops a motorcade to run into a burning building, saving three-year-old twins. October 19th. Inspired by Larry Ellison's purchase of the Hawaiian island of Lanai, the Koch brothers offer $200 billion for Ohio, as is. October 21st, on the way to church, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney personally beats off masked bullies attempting to impale a litter of puppies with nail guns. October 24th, blurry YouTube video surfaces showing Barack Obama before a fundraiser chain-smoking cigarettes in the loading bay of a Toledo convention center. October 28th, the state comptroller of Ohio announces the Koch brothers sale cannot go through because George Soros has already acquired 60% of the state. October 30th, the LA Times releases grainy photographic evidence of Mitt Romney at a Portsmouth, New Hampshire coffee shop ordering and downing three triple espressos.
That's San Francisco political comedian Will Durst, whose views don't necessarily reflect those of KALW News. Well, Election Day is just over a month away, and every Tuesday night until then, you can find Will at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco's Mission District. He's got a one-man show called Elect to Laugh. Find out how to get tickets to see him live at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Political movements don't have to be shaped by politicians. In fact, one of the most dynamic movements to shape the way we see our streets started with a group of bicycle riders in San Francisco who simply wanted to be seen. It's a gathering that's come to be known as Critical Mass. And tomorrow night around 6 o'clock, hundreds, if not thousands, of cyclists from around the world will come together to take over the city streets to celebrate the event's 20th anniversary. It's going to be
quite a scene. The mass has taken place on the last Friday of every month since September of 1992. It's a leaderless bike ride without a pre-planned route, lasting several hours. The concept is to have enough people riding on bikes, a critical mass, to force cars to stop and wait for them. It's controversial, somewhat chaotic, and sometimes confrontational, but it's also effective, and it's grown. Today, critical mass rides take place in more than 300 countries around the world. Urban bike riding has changed significantly in that time. Some would say critical mass helped the world spin a little differently. And that brings us to the topic of today's radical idea, one that's carried on for two decades.
And now for something completely different.
First of all, think outside the box.
I got the idea when I noticed the refrigerator was cold.
Good idea.
The guy who invented Pringles packaging thought outside the box and made a fortune.
That's a pretty good idea.
He had this crazy idea about breeding pine trees.
Isn't that beautiful? That can happen to anyone.
Chris Carlson co-founded Critical Mass. Now, he's an editor of the new book, Shift Happens, Critical Mass at 20. He joined the co-editor Lisa Ruth Elliott in studio with KALW's Ben Trefney to reflect on how Critical Mass got its start.
Well, there was about four dozen people who showed up to it, and it started in the fog of months and months of discussion and beer drinking and hanging out, and a lot of us who were cyclists, either as daily commuters or bike messengers or friends who just rode their bikes recreationally, or in some cases there were a few people trying also to resuscitate the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition from its then rather moribund state. I mean, it existed, but barely. And we were all in conversations at different times and places, but often in my office, which at that time was at 7th and Market in the Grant Building. And out of those conversations, there was a kind of an urge to establish ourselves, make some sort of a statement publicly about the fact that we felt like really mistreated as second-class citizens on the roads, that people would treat you derisively, they'd yell at you, they'd think you're like immature, you're a kid, grow up and get a car. So that was somehow an act of maturity. So we thought, let's meet at the foot of Market Street and just ride home together. Simple act. Get everybody together we can and fill the streets with bikes, and by doing so, displace the cars. And unbelievably, it worked.
So four dozen people was enough to displace the cars?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you really don't need even that many. You can do it with quite few. But the more you have, the more displacement you have. And it's very interesting what happens in the space you've created, because it's a mobile, temporary autonomous zone, if you will. It's a place where things start to happen that are unexpected and unpredictable. And you're rolling down the streets, and this kind of weird and surprising euphoria hit us all on that very first ride. It was like, wow, this is so different. And we start to actually feel the city in its complexity in a different way than we had ever felt it before. We smelled it differently. We tasted it differently. We heard it differently, because we were in our own little zone there. And of course, you're looking around and everybody's very attractive. There's like a lot of libido going on, and it's a very beautiful experience.
So those rides were euphoric for you. They could be a bit of a headache for the car drivers who aren't within that same world at the time. How has that dynamic, how was that initially, Chris, and then how did that develop over time as people became more familiar with mass, or actually maybe didn't?
Motorists often take umbrage at our very appearance that we're even there. And if we don't, you know, there's this big drama about scofflaw cyclists and things like that, which of course is just laughable if you're a cyclist, because every cyclist rolls through stop signs if there's no traffic and pauses at red lights. Some of us go through, some don't. But there's nothing, no harm done, right? But people take great offense at these things because they're sitting in their cars really frustrated and urgently anxious. And so what?
Road rage.
There's road rage always just percolating there, simmering at all times. And so for us to be out on a cycle, having a good time, laughing, smiling, enjoying ourselves, even when we're alone, we might look, you know, relatively more content.
But with critical mass, there's a mass of bicyclists,
right,
whether it's 48 like the first time or thousands like other times, and it's blocking traffic.
Yeah, and people are sitting there stewing and feeling frustrated. And I sympathize with that frustration. That's not fun to be stuck in traffic.
That's Chris Carlson. He's co-founder of Critical Mass and co-editor of the book of essays Shift Happens, Critical Mass at 20, which he worked on with Lisa Ruth Elliott, who's here today as well, and Adriana Camarena. Lisa Ruth, can you tell me about the evolution of Critical Mass as a movement internationally?
Yes, I think there's so much life to Critical Mass outside of San Francisco. It was in 300 cities as of the late 1990s, and it's in many, many more now. And we represent about 31 of those cities in the book, Shift Happens, Critical Mass at 20. You have Ciclo Officina in Italy and Ciclo Officine in France, And all over Europe and Central and South America, these bike workshops are an outgrowth or at least very connected to the people who are doing critical mass.
So does that mean that critical mass, the event on the last Friday of the month, doesn't resemble itself in different cities around the world? Each different place has taken on its own identity?
I think it resembles itself in the sense that it's a mass bicycle ride. But I think that the way that people in Sao Paulo, Brazil, are striping their own bike lanes, in Helsinki, Finland, in the wintertime, they do snowplow critical mass bike rides because nobody cares about keeping the snow and ice off of the bicycle lanes. They do for the car lanes. So they go out with their shovels and they take it, and that becomes the focus of their ride. So in a sense, there's a lot of activism that surrounds it that you don't see everywhere, but it takes on its own flavor wherever it pops up.
Where is the biggest one now?
Oh, well, the biggest one is definitely in Budapest. They do it twice a year. They kind of go through official channels on Earth Day and then also on Car Free Day, which we just had on Saturday, actually, September 22nd.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure. I'm a bicyclist, and I'm not sure I've actually heard of that day.
Exactly. It's such a big celebration day all over the world, and we don't know anything about it here. In Budapest, you can see up to 80,000 cyclists in a critical mass ride, and it's impressive. People riding, taking one entire side of a bridge or in a park, just bicycles as far as you can see. And you can't really imagine. It's kind of this fantasy world of seeing that many people on bikes. And we're not talking about radical people either, necessarily. These are people who use their bike daily. These are families. These are people of all ages. These are mainstream cyclists. These are, you know, first-time cyclists. These are people who are just maybe testing it out. But it's 80,000 people.
That's Lisa Ruth Elliott, who co-edited the book of essays Shift Happens, Critical Mass at 20, with Critical Mass co-founder Chris Carlson and Adriana Camarena. What is the most beautiful thing that you've ever seen, one experience or incident, during your years of riding in the critical mass?
Well, you know, I have been riding since the beginning, and I've ridden in a number of other cities as well, so I've had the very good fortune of having countless great experiences. So, and I've had many of those kinds of experiences in San Francisco. One of the best ones was the 1999 summer ride. That was one of those beautiful summer evenings that we had here where there was no fog and the sun was setting in the Golden Gate, like literally the sun going right down through the bridge. And we were out on the, we ended up out at the Wave Organ at the very end of this.
That must have been quite a scene because it's a pretty narrow passageway.
Yeah, and we had it completely clogged with bicycles. I mean, there was like hundreds of bikes out there. And then there was this tall ship for some reason in the bay. So just the silhouette of that against the sun setting and the Golden Gate and everything, it was one of those iconic moments.
So on the flip side, what's one of the most disturbing things you've seen in the mass?
Worst thing ever is actually a video clip you can see from Porto Alegre, where a banker, a vice president of a bank in Porto Alegre in Brazil, in February 2011, decided, I'm not waiting. And he just put his foot to the gas and went right through 110 bikes at full speed. And bikes are just like, it's like parting of the waves off the front hood of the guy's car, and everybody's screaming, and the sounds of bones and bikes crunching. It's just horrifying. And that's by far the worst incident that's ever happened in critical mass. And luckily, nobody died. And in fact, all the injuries were healed.
Did that person go to prison, or is that still in trial?
It's Brazil.
There's still no outcome.
Well, he's been actually fined. Did not do time.
And sometimes in critical masses, I mean, I've seen myself, there have been aggressive bicyclists. Sometimes cyclists can become aggressive during the mass when they feel empowered, perhaps, and taking over space.
Well, in the very earliest days, we identified the problem as being the testosterone brigade. The aggressive behavior is more like riding into oncoming traffic just to sort of taunt them, or, you know, just kind of pushing the boundaries to feel like you're the tough guy that's being more edgy. And it's kind of childish, frankly, and we are always trying to encourage people to say, well, you know, really, it's way more subversive and actually long-term more politically effective to be invitational and celebratory and say, we're having a great time, join us. And we really genuinely believe in that. That's what most of us have been really trying to do with critical mass for all these years. So when somebody comes in and tries to like create a fake class war between cars and bikes, it's just an embarrassment to us, and we try to convince them to stop.
So what do you expect for the 20th anniversary celebration of critical mass Friday evening?
Well, if it's left up to the cyclists alone, it'll just be a beautiful evening with, you know, really thousands of cyclists rolling through the streets. It'll probably fragment because it'll be such a large ride and end up moving in multiple smaller rides, which are still hundreds and thousands of people.
There's a lot of people I've talked to who said, yeah, this might be the good time to do my first critical mass.
Yeah.
So people are looking for a time to celebrate an anniversary. People are not looking for anything else than that.
But I think everybody's coming out for this one, so it's going to be quite large.
Chris Carlson and Lisa Ruth Elliott are co-editors of the book Shift Happens, Critical Mass at 20. They spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. And you can hear more of their conversation at our website, KALW.org, where they talk about a massive dust-up with then-Mayor Willie Brown.
And it was essentially this madhouse where everybody was dispersed in all these different directions, so you had groups of bikes going everywhere, and it was quite enjoyable if you were in it. You know, it was just such a fun moment to be at that level of craziness going on in the city.
How many bicyclists were there that day?
A lot of people turned up because he had called for the confrontation. So everybody said, okay, we'll throw down on that. And there was at least 5,000 cyclists out there that night, and they went in every direction. Some people went towards the bridge. Other people went up the North Shore. And there was no coordination. It was just spontaneous. People just went everywhere they went.
More from Chris Carlson at KALW.org. And remember, the 20th annual Critical Mass Ride happens tomorrow night at 6 p.m., beginning at the base of Market Street in San Francisco. If you're driving, you might want to stay away. But if you go, we'd love to see your pictures. Post them on our Facebook page or tweet them at us at KALW News. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. If bikes aren't your wheels of choice, maybe skateboards are. If so, you have a new place to thrash if you live in San Francisco, the new Balboa Skate Park. And that brings us to another installment of our community storytelling project, Here, Here.
Here?
Here?
Here.
Okay, together. Okay.
Here, here.
A pop-up radio project from KALW.
We swung by the Balboa Skate Park before its official opening to meet some of the skaters there for today's Here, Here segment.
It's a good idea, definitely, to have a skate park, but I heard it's, like, not open yet, is it? I mean, people have been skating here regardless. They should just open it anyways.
My name is Sir Denzel Lumsey.
Aiden Bowater Skelly.
Vivian Nguyen.
Mario Mancini.
I live in the Mission District.
I live on 25th of Potrero.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Well, I've only been here for like a couple years, but like within the couple years that I've been here, like there's been a lot of improvement.
And they finally made one.
A skate park.
So I'm glad.
I like it so far. Like I want to try to get used to it.
It's all right. It's the bowl is really awesome.
I like the pyramid in the middle. I'm going to be skating that a lot.
And the stair set's great, but they kind of built it in an area where it's going to be wet all the time, which is going to ruin the wood, I think.
I was worried about when it starts raining, you're getting foggy around days around Balboa. It's going to be kind of, like, sketchy a little bit. But try to get used to it and see how it goes.
For the most part, it's pretty cool.
Since a lot of people are skaters around here, gives them something to do and, like, somewhere to skate, you know? Me? No, I don't. I have a lot of friends who do, though. They kind of, like, risk a lot of things, just like do tricks, like they don't care if they get hurt or anything, you know, and like no matter what, like they just keep trying like to nail a trick or something. Like it's pretty cool like how determined they are and motivated.
I've been tired of skating just the same spots over and over. It's finally something new in the city.
They more worry about disabled people and old people. I don't got nothing against them, but they worry about them a lot more, and the young people are like, oh, you know, independent type thing until cops show up and
close to almost everything, you know, like it's close to all the schools. There's like a mall over there.
Yeah, probably gonna come here between my classes. I go to City College, I'll be coming here hopefully. So, yeah, I guess I'm becoming here a lot more.
It would be cool to live downtown, but it's expensive, you know, and like at least we're still in the city and we're by school, and like now there's like a lot of fun stuff to do. We're never bored over here.
Skate hard, we out here, and that's it.
The grand opening of the Balboa Skate Park is this Saturday at noon. There will be a free skate demo and free food. All the details are at KALW.org. That's also where you can hear more from Here, Here. You've been listening listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Audrey Dilling, Julie Kane, Nina Gensler-Debs, Maya DePaula Hanika, Alyssa Kapnick, RTM's Konohovs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, Antoine Etsu, and RJ Sloan. Chris Hoff engineered today's show. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We're listener-supported radio. And one more thing. Thanks in large part to your support, we've had some great things to celebrate. One is the successful pledge drive we completed last week. Thank you again. And two, it was just announced that KALW is receiving 4 awards from the Northern California branch of the Society of Professional Journalists. Julie Kane for Arts and Culture reporting on her documentary Squeeze Box Stories.
Russian entrepreneur. Can I say that word as a Kansan? This is where my accent comes in.
Erica Moo for explanatory journalism on her series about dealing with mental health as an Asian American.
I'm feeling a little nasally, unfortunately, but that's okay.
The staff of Your Call for community journalism.
Ooh. Did you hear that? Bubbles.
And our own engineers, Chris Hoff and Seth Samuel, who make the sound of this show. They're being honored as the unsung heroes of Bay Area journalism.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
I like coffee, and I am addicted to caffeine. My name is Seth Samuel.
I'm Chris Hoff, and I like to say things in dead languages.
Way to go, team. And thanks again for all your support. You're listening to the Corte Madera Town Band. They'll be closing out the summer music series at Town Center Corte Madera on Sunday, starting at about 2 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.